This is Audible.
Harlequin Audio is proud to bring you Before I Let You Go by Kelly Rimmer. Performed by Vanessa Johansson and Amy Landon. One. Lexi. When my landline rings at 2 a.m. on a Thursday morning, I know who's at the other end of the line before I pick it up. Only one person in my life would call at that hour. The same person who wouldn't hesitate to ask for something after 2 years of silence. The same person who wouldn't give a single thought to the fact that I need to be at work by 8 a.m. As I bring the handset to my ear, I brace myself for the one thing that contact with my little sister has brought me in recent years. Chaos. Annie? Lexi? Annie's voice breaks on a sob. You have to help me. I think I'm dying. I sit up and push my hair out of my face. My fiancé, Sam, had been asleep on the bed beside me, but he sits up too. I glance at him and see sleepy confusion cross his face. As a physician, I periodically have late-night calls regarding patient emergencies, but never via the landline. I've moved houses twice since I last spoke to Annie, but I've always made sure the same number followed me, just in case she wanted or needed to reconnect. Now, here she is, and just like I always feared, she's calling me because she's got an emergency on her hands. What's going on? I ask.
My head hurts so much, and nothing helps the pain. I'm seeing double, and my feet are swollen, and...
They are troubling symptoms, but as Annie speaks, I recognize the slur that indicates she is high. Frustration floods me, and I sigh impatiently. You're 30 now, Annie. Are you ever going to grow up? Go to the hospital, I say. I feel Sam stiffen on the bed beside me at the hard edge of my tone. He's never heard me speak like that, and I turn toward him again, an apology in my gaze. It hurts me to be cold with Annie. It even hurts to recognize how only seconds into this phone call, I'm already boiling up inside with impatience and frustration toward her. This is my baby sister. This is the same kid I shared a room with for our entire childhood. The same sweet 9-year-old who used to beg me to play mommies and daddies with her after our dad died. But I've been dealing with her addiction for years, and even after a 2-year break from the drama, the weariness returns as soon as she does. If this was a one-off, I'd probably panic and rush to her aid. But it's not. I have lost count of Annie's desperate 2 a.m. phone calls. I couldn't even tally the times she has gotten herself into a hopeless situation and called me to find her a solution.
Lexi, I can't.
Annie chokes now. I wait, expecting some long-winded story about not having health insurance or having a warrant out for her arrest or something simpler, like not even having a car or having woken up from a binge to find herself lost. When the silence stretches, I know I need to end the call. I try to push the phone call to its inevitable conclusion as I prompt her, Well?
Lexi, I'm pregnant. I can't go to the hospital. I just can't.
I've been a GP for several years. I thought my poker face was pretty good, but I'm not prepared for this. I gasp and feel Sam's gentle arm snake around my waist. He rests his chin on my shoulder, then presses a soft kiss against my cheek. My first instinct is to assume Annie is lying. It wouldn't be the first time, although she generally lies only for some financial or pharmaceutical payoff. The last vestiges of sleep clear from my brain, and I quickly consider the situation. There is something different about this scenario. Annie isn't asking me for money. She is asking for help. If you're pregnant, then those symptoms are even more troubling. You need to get to a hospital. Annie speaks again, her voice stronger and clearer. She is determined to make me understand, and there's no way I can ignore her plea. If I go to the hospital, I'll fail the drug test. I just can't. I slide my legs over the edge of the bed, straighten my posture, and take a deep breath. I'm immediately resigned to what this call is going to mean. Annie is back. This peaceful period of my life is over. Tell me where you are. Sam tries to convince me that there are smarter ways to approach this situation than jumping in the car myself. Just think about it for a second, he says quietly. This is the same sister who nearly got you fired 2 years ago, right? I bristle at his pointed tone, and I'm scowling as I reply, She needs me, Sam. She needs medical help. And even if we go there right now, the best we can probably do for her is to call an ambulance anyway. So why don't we just do that in the first place? Because her situation is complicated, and they won't understand. If I go to her, I can talk sense into her. I know I can. There's a hint of impatience in his eyes as he scans my face in the semi-darkness. But then he sighs and throws back the covers on the bed. What are you doing? I frown at him, and he walks briskly toward the wardrobe as he mutters, I'm not letting you go to some trailer park by yourself at 3 o'clock in the morning. But you have surgery all day tomorrow, Sam. This isn't your problem. Lexi, your problems are my problems now. I'll be fine, and if I'm not, I'll postpone the surgeries. If you're going, I'm going. So either call an ambulance and get back into bed, or let's go. So I let him come with me. But even as he drives across the city, I feel anxiety grinding in my gut. Sam knows only the basics about Annie's issues. He's been supportive and understanding. But at the end of the day, he's from one of those old-money northeastern families. The biggest scandal in his entire lineage is his parents' somewhat amicable divorce. And now, 4 months after our engagement, here he is looking for an obscure trailer park in the middle of the night to give medical care to my pregnant, drug-addicted sister. He hasn't ever met Mom, and I'm not sure he ever will. I haven't seen her myself for almost 2 decades, not since the day of my 16th birthday, when I walked out of the strict religious sect she moved Annie and me into after Dad's death. We speak on the phone from time to time, despite that being against the rules of her community. Since Annie and I turned our back on the sect, we're dead to them. I hate calling her, because I usually hang up feeling lonely. A call to Mom is like telephoning another planet. She's so disconnected from my world, and I have completely rejected hers. I try to keep an open mind as we drive. I don't want to think the worst of Annie, but it seems like her situation has gone from bad to worse over the past 2 years. I think of her every day, but in my thoughts, she has lived a much healthier life than the one I fear I'm about to see. It was the only way I'd been able to deal with throwing her out of my house 2 years ago. I imagine that she was working somewhere, maybe writing again. Maybe she has a nice little apartment, like the one she had in Chicago after she graduated. I pictured her dating and going out with friends and shopping for clothes at little boutiques. Annie always had such a beautiful sense of style, back when she cared about how she looked. It's well after 3 a.m. when we find the place. It's an older-style trailer, and even in the semi-darkness of the trailer park, there is no denying that Annie is somewhere near rock bottom. The trailer is falling to bits. One side is dented, as if it's been in some kind of car accident, and there's black tape holding a panel in place. There is an awning at the front, but the support beneath it is damaged too, so one corner of the roof leans down toward the ground. Trash cans are stacked against it, each overflowing with waste so that a scattered carpet of filth rests over the ground beneath the awning. There's a narrow path through that trash right to the front door, and inside the trailer, the soft yellow glow of a light beckons. As soon as the car pulls to a stop beside the awning, I reach for the door handle. But before I can open it, Sam takes my other hand in his. If things are too messed up in there, we're calling an ambulance and going home, okay? She's harmless, Sam, I promise him. Annie is only a danger to herself. I trust you, he says. That's why we're here. But there's only so much we are going to be able to do for her without a hospital. If she has preeclampsia, we'll need to force her to go. Right? I know, I say on a sigh. Let's just play it by ear, okay? As we walk toward the trailer, Sam walks so close to me that I can feel his breath on the back of my neck. The door swings slowly open, and then Annie is there. Once upon a time, I was so jealous of her beautiful blonde hair and her bright blue eyes and those delicate elfin features. The woman who stands before me now is nothing more than a shadow of my beautiful sister. The blonde hair is now wiry and thin and hangs around her face in matted tendrils. Her eyes are sunken, her skin sallow, and through her parted lips, I see the telltale black marks of rot on the edges of her front teeth. My eyes drift downward, and I take in the jutting ball of her bump, a horrifying contrast to her otherwise skeletal frame. I'm not seeing my sister. I'm seeing a wasteland after war. If I wasn't so desperate to help her, I might turn away and sob. Thanks for coming, Annie says. Now that I can actually see her, I identify a quality in her voice that had eluded me over the phone. Yes, she is weary. Yes, she is scared. Yes, she is tired. But more than all that, Annie is broken. She has called me because she had exhausted all other options. I climb up the stairs and duck to step inside Annie's trailer. I see the unmade bed, the old-style TV, the vinyl-clad table. Every single surface is littered with trash, but there are piles of books haphazardly stacked among the mess. Annie was an English major. She worked for a children's book publisher, and she had some short stories published in magazines. At one stage, she was even working on a book of her own. It's heartbreaking to see the books in this place. The one throwback to the life she has lost. Who is this? Annie asks, and she nods towards Sam. He is a big man, a broad man, and he looks so cramped in this tiny trailer. He has to bow his head to stand. As I look between Sam and Annie, I can barely believe that both of these people are now technically my family. They couldn't be more different. This is Sam, I murmur. He's my fiancé. He's a doctor, too. Of course he is. Annie sinks onto the bed and shoots me a withering look. Only the best for our Lexi. Do you want help or not? Sam says before I can respond. Rather than feeling pleased for his automatic defense of me, I feel instant and bewildering irritation. Annie is startled by his short tone. Her gaze snaps from my face to his, and then color floods her starkly white cheeks until she looks feverish. She doesn't answer Sam. Instead, she rubs her belly gently with her palms, and she lifts her legs up onto the bed. My gaze zeroes in on her monstrously bloated feet, swollen to nearly double their normal size, the skin pitted around her ankles. I was already nervous for Annie, but my heart sinks at the sight of those feet. I scan my eyes over her body and survey her belly. How many months? I ask. It's difficult to assess how far into the pregnancy she is because her bump is tiny. But then again, so is she. I'm collating a mental catalog of what I know of heroin use in pregnancy, assuming that's the drug she still favors. If she's been using for the whole pregnancy, the baby's growth may have suffered. I think I'm due soon, Annie says. I haven't seen a doctor. Not at all? I wince as the judgmental words leave my mouth to hang in the room between us. Annie's eyes plead with me to understand, as if I could, as if there is any excuse for what she's just told me. After a fraught pause, she shakes her head, and a tear drains out of the corner of her eye to run over her weathered cheek. She wraps her arms around her bump protectively, but when she looks at me, her guilt is palpable. I approach the bed and motion towards Sam, indicating that he should pass me the medical kit he's carrying. His hand descends upon my shoulder, and he gently steers me toward the cracked vinyl chair that runs alongside the small dining table. "I'll assess her," he says. His tone is gentle, but the words are firm. I shake my head, and Sam's gaze sharpens. "She's your sister. You need to let me do this." I open my mouth to protest, but Sam isn't going to back down. So I sigh and sit slowly. At the last minute, the urge to care for Annie myself surges again, and I straighten and shake my head. "She is my sister, Sam," I say. "That's why I should be the one to assess her." Sam doesn't budge, and his gaze doesn't waver. "You know as well as I do that you're too close. You can't possibly make an impartial assessment here. Your judgment will be clouded." Sam's gaze becomes pleading. "Lexi, please, let me do this." I sit, but as I do, my fingers twitch against my thighs and my foot taps against the floor of the trailer. The urge to take charge is so great that even my body is revolting. I've never been good at sitting back when a problem needed solving, particularly not when it came to my family. The only thing that stops me from pushing him aside and reviewing her condition myself is that he's right. I'm far too close to this situation to remain objective. Besides, this is Sam, the person I trust more than anyone else in the world. He sits on the bed beside Annie and withdraws a digital blood pressure machine from his pack. After he fixes it to her arm, he offers her a reassuring smile. "Can you tell us a bit about what's going on?" "I started getting headaches last week, but they're getting worse. Tonight I couldn't see. Everything was doubled and blurry." Sam leans over and palpates Annie's belly, then picks up his stethoscope and listens near her belly button. After a moment or two, I see his shoulders relax just a little, and I know he's found a heartbeat. He continues listening, and I'm desperate to know how stable the rhythm is. "How long have your feet been like that?" I ask Annie. "Maybe a week? I'm not sure." The digital machine beeps several times to indicate a problem. I lean forward, and I'm not surprised to see the numbers flash on the screen. 160 over 120. Annie and the baby are definitely in trouble. I fumble for my phone. Do I call an ambulance? Sam doesn't seem to be panicking, and perhaps I wouldn't be either if Annie were a patient who had walked into my office. But right now, I'm simply a terrified sister. "Has the baby been moving, Annie?" Sam asks as he rises away from her belly. "I think so." Sam turns to stare at me. Our eyes lock. "Annie," I say gently, "we have to get you to a hospital now."
"Lexi, I can't." Annie chokes. "My friend failed a drug test last year and they took her baby. Her son went into foster care and she never got him back. I can't let that happen to my baby. I just can't."
I want to point out the dozens of reasons why she shouldn't be allowed to bring a baby home to this place at all, especially given her current state of mind. The mess of her life could not be more evident. But those shockingly high numbers on the BP machine are burned into the forefront of my thoughts. Annie needs urgent medical attention. This is not the time to lecture her about her addiction or her suitability as a parent. This is the time to persuade her, and I have to tread lightly. But despite this, I know that Annie is probably right about the drug test. If she fails a narcotics test, it's quite likely she'll be charged with chemically endangering a child, and that's a felony in Alabama. I've never had it happen to a patient personally, but I've heard of several cases in the media. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. The immediate need is to get her to a hospital to push antihypertension drugs into her system to bring her blood pressure down. Plus, that baby needs urgent monitoring, proper monitoring, not the very limited heart rate check we can do here. And if we don't move fast, there might not even be a baby to save. I don't want to tell Annie this, in part because I don't want to stress her further and push her blood pressure even higher. But if explaining the immediate threat to her baby's health is off the table, I don't know what I'll say to convince her. I'm relieved when Sam rescues me. Annie, I know this is hard, but your condition is very poor and the baby is in serious danger. There is only so much Lexi and I can do for you here. We'll take you to my hospital, and I promise you, you'll get the very best medical care possible. But I'll be arrested, Annie says. She wraps her arms around her belly again and shakes her head. I can't. I just can't. I won't let that happen, I promise her. I have no idea if that's true, but I'm so desperate that I'll say pretty much anything to get her to the hospital. Annie slowly raises her eyes toward me. There is both fear and hope in her gaze. But suddenly, I don't see her haggard appearance or the pitiful trailer. I just see my baby sister, the little girl who used to see the world as a place of wonder, a child of limitless creativity and potential. I see her sitting frozen under the tree in our front yard, holding my hand with a death grip as we watched the procession of mourners stream into our house after Dad's funeral, trusting me to take care of her, just as I'd always promised Dad I would. I see the child who faced our childhood with courage, the child with a simple optimism and faith that we'd make it through together. I see the girl with an innate sense of fairness who rallied and fought against the rules of our strict childhood home. And then the determined young woman who marched right on out of there when she could take it no longer. Creativity, passion, courage, optimism. In this moment, I see only the essence of who Annie really is. Suddenly she is not an addict or a potential criminal, not even a somewhat negligent soon-to-be mother. She is simply my Annie, and she is sick, and she needs my support. Maybe this is the moment when it all turns around. You promise it will be okay? She chokes. I lean over and I take her hand in mine and I squeeze it hard. Is this going to haunt me? Perhaps, but I can imagine a worse fate. I promise you.
2. Annie. To Luke. You told me to write the things I can't say, so here I'm sitting in my room with a pen in my hand. I haven't written in years, and I can't believe I'm writing in this journal. It's the only possession I've ever kept for more than a year or two. This notebook has been sacred to me, right from the day I got it, the best day of my life. May 28, 1993. It was the day before summer break and the whole school had shuffled into the auditorium for the end-of-year awards ceremony. I saw Dad as soon as I stepped through the door. He had such a presence about him. He was tall and strong, with thick blonde hair and that huge smile he wore whenever he saw us. I knew that he must be there for Lexi. She always won an end-of-year award. Mom taught second grade, so she was always at the presentation. But this was the first year Dad turned up. I figured Lexi must have done something quite extraordinary to warrant him missing a shift, and I was excited to see what it was. I kept glancing over my shoulder to look for Dad at the back of the room with the other parents, and if I angled my head just right, I could see him beaming toward the stage. Even now, if I close my eyes, I can still picture him like that, the proud, expectant smile on his face, his clean-shaven jaw strong, and his blue eyes sparkling. After a while, Dad saw me peeking at him, and he gave me a wave and a grin. Lexi won her usual academic achievement award, and I clapped so hard that my palms stung. When she was on stage accepting it, she looked down at my class, and she beamed right at me. I was so proud of her. I don't think it even occurred to me to be jealous. And then something completely and beautifully unexpected happened. the principal announced that this year there was a new prize that had been arranged for a uniquely gifted student. I assumed it would be an award for Lexi. Everyone knew she was the smartest kid in school, and she was going to middle school the following year, so it made sense for them to honor her one last time. But then the principal said the right last name, but the wrong first name. Annie Vidler. I waited for him to correct himself. My teacher came toward me in a crouch and waved at me to go toward the stage, and I gave her a confused glance. Why would I win a special award? The only unique thing about me was that Lexi Vidler was my sister. By the time I got to the podium, I was dizzy with confusion and embarrassment, and I thought that any second now the principal would realize his mistake and everyone was going to laugh at me for thinking that I might win a prize. But then he shook my hand, and he passed me a certificate, and said into the microphone, "This award goes to Annie Vidler for extraordinary achievements in creative writing. Annie's poetry and stories have amazed the teaching staff this year, and we felt it important to recognize such an exceptional talent." And then I looked out at my whole school, somewhere between spellbound and dumbfounded, and I saw that Lexi was on her feet clapping with her hands over her head, and Mom was standing on the side of the room, still beside her class but wiping a tear from her cheek. And even my dad was standing on his chair at the back of the room cheering and clapping. He pumped his fist in the air and I saw him shout, and the applause felt like thunder rolling over me. Dad carried me home on his shoulders that day. Lexi told me she was jealous that they made an award just for me, for all of her achievements that had never happened to her. Mom let me pick the restaurant for dinner. I picked Italian because I knew everyone liked it. While we waited for dessert, Dad and Mom gave me a present wrapped in silver foil with a big pink ribbon around it. It was this journal. "For my future writer," Dad said. "I can't wait to see where your talent takes you, my little love." That night, Dad tucked me into my bed with a notepad and my arms cuddled close to me like a teddy bear. I remember thinking that my notepad was too precious to use on ordinary words, so I'd have to save it until I could come up with a worthy story. It's telling that I'm 30 years old and I've only just written in it today, and only because you suggested it. Maybe the only thing that makes this story special enough for this journal is that I'm clutching at straws. I've tried everything else to get better. Maybe this link back to those happier times with Dad has some magical power that methadone maintenance programs and rapid detox regimens and inpatient rehab centers do not. The day I got this journal was the very best day of my life, which is pretty pathetic, isn't it? But I do still remember every aspect of it, from the chalky smell of the auditorium, to the feel of Dad's strong shoulders beneath my legs as he carried me home, to the taste of the Parmesan on my spaghetti at dinner. I remember most of all the way that, although he'd swapped his standard day shift to a night shift so he could make it to the assembly, and although he really had to go to work that night, Dad lingered in the room I shared with Lexi after he put us to bed. For the first time, I could see that he was every bit as proud of me as he was of her.
"Look after your baby sister, huh?"
Dad said to Lexi when he finally rose to leave. He often said that to her, ever since they brought me home as a newborn and she was jealous of all the attention I got.
"You were so cute," Mom used to tell me. "We had to convince her that we actually got you just for her so she wasn't jealous."
Long after my cuteness had worn off, the phrase lingered, meaningless other than a small reminder to us both that as sisters we belonged, in some small way, to each other. But that night, as she did every other time Dad said it, Lexi nodded with utmost seriousness, and even after Dad had left the room and I was drifting off to sleep, I heard her say softly,
"I'm proud of you too, Annie."
Those words meant so much, and the day meant so much, and I closed my eyes that night, as the happiest 7-year-old in the world. But although it was a great day, Luke, I actually remember the exact date, not because that was the best day, but because the worst days followed.
3. Lexi. Annie freaks out when Sam tries to call an ambulance, and I calm her by suggesting that we could maybe just drive her. Soon we are making our way to the car, heading for Sam's hospital, and the panic within me gives way to dread. There are closer hospitals and certainly more suitable options, but he is adamant that she will get the best care with his colleagues. Annie hesitates again when she realizes that Sam works at one of the more upmarket hospitals in the county. Maybe she's worried about the bill. Well, if she is, that makes two of us. Can't we just wait until morning and go to Lexi's clinic? She asks, and I almost wish we could. At least then I could keep her from his workplace. You need to be admitted to a proper hospital. My clinic doesn't have the right facilities. My hospital, Sam repeats firmly. It's the best option. Still, I catch his arm after he helps her into his car and pushes the door closed. But she won't have insurance, I whisper, somewhat awkwardly. It's fine, Lexi. She's family. We'll take care of it, is all he says. I spend the 35-minute drive worrying about how this is going to play out. Sam's parents covered his tuition, but I have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt between my student loans and the credit cards I used to put Annie through rehab. Plus, Sam and I did just buy the house, and the bill for Annie's treatment could be immense. Maybe Sam will get a staff discount, and Medicaid will surely cover some of it, but even so, this is likely a huge financial undertaking. I'd have covered her bills myself, probably without even thinking twice about it. But Sam is involved now, and it feels wrong for him to pay for Annie's care. And then there's the potential for untold drama. The last time I let Annie near my clinic, she was caught breaking in one night raiding the meds cabinet, and I almost lost my job over it. Annie is in the front seat, and I'm in the back, so I can't actually talk to Sam about my concerns. We will just have to sort it out later, once the emergency passes and we're sure the baby is fine. As he drives, Sam calls the obstetrics ward on the Bluetooth car kit and briefs the consultant obstetrician on the situation. I notice the way that he carefully avoids any reference to Annie's addiction, other than a quiet murmur right toward the end of the call, when he simply says, "There is potential for the infant to suffer NAS." I doubt Annie knows what NAS stands for, but I know. Neonatal Abstinence Syndrome. It's a cruel start to life. All of the physical symptoms of opiate withdrawal, crammed and compressed into a tiny newborn's body. I saw a few cases during the obstetrics rotation of residency. I watched those little babies shake and scream for hours on end, until they'd sweated through their clothing and vomited up every drop of milk in their stomachs. We treat NAS in much the same way that we treat heroin withdrawals, with gradually decreasing doses of opiates. But it's a very difficult condition to manage. There's nothing worse in the world than watching a brand new baby writhe in an agony that could have been avoided. I'm about to welcome a new niece or nephew who will have one of the worst possible starts to life. There is only one upside to this situation. Most NAS babies come through the awful early weeks relatively unscathed. Long-term outcomes are usually good, as long as the baby goes home to a stable environment. I stare at Annie, sitting in the front seat quietly weeping, and wonder if there is any chance of that happening in this case. What kind of upbringing can she offer this baby? And who else is there to support this child? Where is the father? Is my sister's entire support network me? When we reach the hospital, Sam parks in his staff parking spot and turns to me.
I'm going to get Annie a wheelchair. Can you please wait with her?
When Sam leaves the car, Annie finally speaks. I've really fucked things up this time, haven't I? You need to stay calm, Annie.
I tried, Lexi, I promise you.
Does Mom know about the baby? I ask. Annie shakes her head. Can I tell her? Or do you want to? We can call her in the morning.
No, I don't want to worry her. I'll get clean first, then we can call her. I just need to get my shit together.
Annie's voice is starting to wobble, and I realize this isn't the time to have this conversation, so I let the subject drop. We sit in silence for a while, other than the lingering echoes of her sporadic sobs.
Sam seems nice, she says eventually.
Sam is wonderful. I look out the window to see him approaching us with the wheelchair. Wait here a second. Before she can respond, I slide out and shut the door behind myself. Sam parks the wheelchair beside Annie's door and stares at me over the roof of the car.
Are you okay? Sam asks me. His eyes are bloodshot, and there are already bags hanging beneath them. He won't be operating today, which means that 5 or 6 patients will have to wait for their surgery. Sam is a general surgeon. These were unlikely to be life-saving or critical surgeries, but it's still a huge inconvenience. The patients will now have to wait weeks or months for their operations to be rescheduled. This is what happens whenever Annie re-enters my life. Things fall to bits, and she's always oblivious to how the effects flow on and on beyond her. It's remarkable how one person's presence can disrupt every little thing that is ordinarily secure. I know it's too late to go somewhere else, but I can't hold back my reluctance to proceed. We shouldn't have come here, Sam, I say quietly, keeping my voice low so that Annie will not overhear us. We should have gone over to Montgomery Public. You don't understand what happens when she's around. She's chaos personified. It's just too risky for her to be in your hospital. If she's here, she'll be treated well. The nursing staff will give her extra attention, and there's a high-risk obstetrician I trust implicitly. Her name is Eliza Rogers, and I'm going to call her in the morning to ask her to care for Annie personally. Trust me, Lexi. This is for the best. Plus, your clinic is only a few blocks away, and our place is only a 20-minute drive. She's going to need us. Annie doesn't just come into your life and pass through it. She takes prisoners and leaves a trail of destruction. Well, whatever happens, we'll handle it together. Right? I hesitate again, and Sam raises his eyebrows at me. Look, we're just going to have to talk about this later. She needs treatment now. He's right, and I know it. I force my thoughts away as I help Annie into the wheelchair. For better or worse, she's here now. Sam navigates the wheelchair through a maze of brightly lit hallways, and he's nearing the ward when I finally glance at my sister. I find her staring at the floor, her jaw set, hard. Guilt rises, as I wonder if she'd heard my conversation with Sam over the roof of the car. Are you okay? I ask her quietly, and she slowly raises her eyes to me and says, Have I ever been okay, Lexi? I don't know how to answer, but while I'm fumbling for words, we arrive at the maternity ward. Things begin to move quickly. Annie is sent to give a urine sample and then taken to a private room. A monitoring unit is fitted to her belly, and after several failed attempts by a nurse, the consultant manages to fix an IV into Annie's arm. No one mentions her collapsed veins or the pockmarked scars along her inner elbow. No one says aloud what I know they are thinking, what I'm thinking, although I hate myself for it. Filthy drug addict. We are medical professionals. We know addiction is a disease. We know how hard it is to beat and how hard it is to access treatment around here. Between meth and narcotics, there's an epidemic of addiction in this state, and there aren't enough rehab centers. Then there's her pregnancy, which would disqualify her from treatment at all but a handful of rehab centers in the entire country. Annie represents an impossible mix of circumstances that the rehab industry just isn't equipped to deal with. I know this. Her doctors know it. Her nurses know it. But we aren't just medical professionals. We are also human beings. And Annie is in a truly terrible state. She's lying on the bed now, but she's restless and she's scratching compulsively around the sores and scabs on her arms and mouth. Every now and again, she noisily blows her nose or dissolves into fits of compulsive sneezing, all symptoms of her body craving the next fix. Even I can't stop an instinctive feeling of disgust at the sight of her, and an automatic fury on behalf of the baby who's been dragged along for the chemical ride. I'm ashamed of that, as her sister and as a doctor. But the feeling is as natural as my next breath. I see it in the staff treating her, too. I see it in the way they hesitate for just a second before they touch her, in the silent frowns and narrowed gazes, even in the way their glances flick toward the door again and again as they wait for her to stabilize. I know they want to get out of this room, to move their attention on to more worthy, less uncomfortable patients.
The professional thing to do would be to reserve our judgment. The best we can offer is to judge quietly. Our training tells us that addiction is a disease, too. A disease with no real cure. A disease that's difficult to treat. But human nature wants to ignore that training and to pretend it's some kind of moral weakness that has brought Annie to where she is now. Maybe we need to believe she's chosen this life, or that she deserves it somehow, because the alternative is unbearable, unfathomable. Even if she is completely blameless, we're still going to be repulsed by her. And besides which, if she's a pregnant drug addict because she's a bad person, then she's not like us. We're good people. We could never find ourselves in her position. We are comforted by our sense of smug superiority. It's a security blanket, a shield. The IV is finally seated in Annie's arm. I crane my neck to see what drug has been prescribed, but I can't make out the label. What are you treating her with?
You're Ms. Vidler's sister?
The consultant frowns at me as he looks up from his chart, and I frown right back at him. I am, I say. Then I add, I'm Dr. Alexis Vidler.
Well, doctor or not, I'm not sure you should be in here while we're stabilizing her. Please, Ron, let her stay for support,
Sam intervenes. And the consultant sighs, but he nods. I open my mouth to ask again about the drugs they have just added to her IV, and Sam shoots me a pointed look and presses his forefinger to his lips. I watch the clear liquid drip through toward her veins, winding its way down into her body. Would it be nifedipine? Or labetalol? What dose have they got her on? If it's not high enough, they are just wasting time. What if I don't speak up, and they don't get the pressure down quickly enough, and what if...
Can you just tell me how you're planning on treating her?
I blurt. And Sam takes my hand and very gently tugs me toward the door. I plant my feet hard against the vinyl floor and he pulls a little harder. When I resist, he gives me an exasperated look.
But she's my sister, Sam, I protest fiercely.
Tonight is apparently a night for firsts. I met Sam at a physician's networking event, but I've never once seen him speak to a patient. I imagine that he would use the kind of tone he uses on me now. Supportive, but also firm. He's never needed to speak to me that way, and I find it both disarming and irritating.
Exactly. So if you can't leave them to do their work, you'll need to wait in the hall.
I groan in frustration and snatch my arm away from him, then walk to sit on a chair at the corner of the room. Sam follows me and sits beside me, but he doesn't take my hand.
Annie, the consultant says quietly, are you on a maintenance program?
Annie scowls at him.
Do I look like I'm on a maintenance program?
The doctor's expression doesn't change.
Okay, so can you tell me what your usual usage is like?
My usage?
She repeats, and she laughs bitterly. Annie, I say gently, and she turns her gaze to me. I see the stain on her cheeks. She's embarrassed to be discussing this with them, and maybe it's worse because I'm in the room. Well, I'm not going anywhere, so she's just going to have to get over it. I prompt her gently, please talk to him. It's really important. Annie swallows, and her gaze falls to the shape of her feet, hidden now by the hospital blanket. After a minute, she says unevenly,
at least half a gram a day. My last bump was about 8 o'clock last night.
Thank you, the doctor says, and he types into the computer, then adds, I'll need to consult with a specialist, but I think the best option is going to be split-dosed methadone.
I'm not going on a fucking maintenance program, she snaps,
and I sigh and run my hand through my hair. Sam reaches across between the chairs and squeezes my knee gently. I grimace silently at him.
Given how heavy your use is, it's going to be a very uncomfortable stay if you don't agree to something to prevent the withdrawal, Anne.
The consultant says, firmer now. Annie glares at him.
That's why it's not going to be a long stay.
Annie,
I interject quietly. Will you agree to take some methadone, just to get you through the next few hours, until we can get your blood pressure stable? Annie's gaze narrows. Can I do that? Of course. You can withdraw your consent for it any time, but taking it now will ease off the withdrawal symptoms for a while, so the hypertension drugs have some time to work. Fine, Annie snaps. Just this once. It's always like this with her. The big battle for her sobriety has been a marathon series of much smaller battles that each needed my careful, attentive management and focus. I'd almost forgotten how difficult she can be. In the seconds after Annie agrees to the maintenance drug, I close my eyes for a moment and try to gather myself. Sam releases my knee, but he slides his arm around my shoulders and pulls me gently against him. I feel the brush of his lips against my hair. I'm okay, I whisper to him. I know, he whispers back. Sam holds me for a while as we sit and watch the staff work. I glean tiny pieces of information as I eavesdrop. There was some protein in Annie's urine, but not a lot, which may mean she has preeclampsia, and she will need to be very closely monitored. She has, inevitably, failed the narcotics test. Annie responds quickly to the antihypertension medication, and her blood pressure finally levels out, then starts to drop. They give her a sonogram with a portable machine right there in front of us, but Annie is becoming drowsy from the medication and is only half awake to see her child on the screen. I watch the shadow of a smile pass her lips as the first image swims into focus. I move closer to the monitor, and while I've seen countless sonography scans in my time, there's something different about this one. The baby's body shape appears, and as I identify its form, it's no longer a fetus. It's my sister's baby, my niece or nephew. For all of her faults, Annie already loves it, and in some bizarre way, I already love it too, just because it's hers. The sonographer measures the velocity of the blood passing through the placenta and umbilical cord, and then in the baby's brain. The measurements are all within safe ranges, at least now that Annie's blood pressure is stabilized. The baby's femur and humerus lengths suggest that Annie is probably about 35 weeks into the pregnancy, but the baby's belly is much smaller than it should be. This is a typical pattern for a fetus with a growth restriction, but that's expected, given Annie's addiction and her blood pressure issues. Yeah, this little one is going to be tiny, the sonographer confirms quietly. But things look okay, considering. This is the closest thing to good news that I could have hoped for given the circumstances, and I flash a teary smile toward Sam, who offers an equally weak smile in response. There's a long road ahead of us, but for now, Annie and the baby are safe. I release a long, heavy breath, and I decide I'll shift closer to the bed so I can hold Annie's hand as she sleeps. Sam has other ideas. Let's get a coffee. I can't leave her, I say. He offers me a quizzical smile. She's sleeping. Let's take a minute while things are calm. The sonographer is packing up, and the flurry of nurses and doctors is easing. Still, I hesitate. Her situation could change in an instant. It's unlikely, though. She's on the meds now, and even if something does change, at least there are monitors fitted so the staff can react. Okay, I say with a sigh, and he rises and gently pulls me to my feet. Sam leads the way to a table in the corner of the cafeteria, and we sit opposite one another. Hospital cafeterias are creepy places in the middle of the night. I've never been to this one before, but I somehow still miss the swarming mass of staff hastily eating between crises, and the overwhelmed fathers trying to inhale coffee between diaper changes, and the teary relatives grieving bad news. The cafeteria is always a place of extremes, but it's never more uncomfortable than when it's empty. For a while we sit in silence. I nurse my coffee and stare down into the black liquid while I try to collect my thoughts.
There is a swirling mess of ideas and concerns and worries in my mind, and I try to pick out one to speak to Sam about, but then all of a sudden I can think of only one thing to say. Sorry. I blurt out the word, almost pleading with him to accept it, as if this were all my fault, as if an apology could make it all better if only he says, that's all right. Maybe there is something to my guilt. After all, I have buried my head in the sand for the last 2 years. I have made a dreadful, unforgivable mistake by not checking on my sister at least every now and again. I should have known how bad things were. I should have known how desperate she was. Honey? Sam raises an eyebrow at me. None of this is your fault. But this will get worse, you know? It's never one thing with Annie. Well, at least she's asking for help now. The baby's heart rate was all over the place. Another few days and it would have been too late. They'll have to report her. I know. Do you think she'll be charged? Well, Annie can't really handle any stress at the moment. Maybe we can convince them to wait a little bit. And then? I don't know, Lexi. We really are going to have to take this as it comes. Sam says, and he sighs and says reluctantly, You shouldn't have promised her that there would be a way around prosecution. I know. Here comes the guilt again. I bite at my lip. Then I whisper, I just wanted to make her come in for treatment. She'll forgive me, won't she? You probably saved your baby's life. Maybe hers, too. So if she doesn't forgive you, that's on her, not you. The conversation stalls again, and I stare at my coffee and try not to cry. After a while, Sam reaches across the table and squeezes my forearm. You haven't told me much about her, only that you've been estranged and that she has an addiction. How long has it been since you spoke to her? About 2 years. The last time I saw her was a few months before you and I met. There is an echoing sadness in Sam's eyes. What happened? She moved in with me the year after she finished college. We had some rough years, stints in rehab, ups and downs, you can imagine. But then I started my job at the clinic, and I really thought she was doing better. She was in a methadone program, and although she absolutely hated it, things seemed stable. But then one night, she broke into the clinic. They caught her in the meds room. Tears threaten again, and this time there is no stopping them. I groan and reach for a napkin to wipe my eyes. It was my fault. I'd let her get into the habit of coming in to visit me at work occasionally. I thought she was just lonely. I should have known she was trying to figure out how to break in. I'd left my security pass on the hall table, and I'd forgotten my PIN code a few times, so I'd been stupid enough to set it to the same one we used at home. It just didn't even occur to me that she'd ever do anything to risk my career. I can't imagine Oliver took that very well, Sam says, referring to my boss at the clinic. That is the understatement of the century. I sigh. He would have been pissed if she'd just broken in. But she didn't smash a window. She walked in through the front door and right into the meds room because of my carelessness. I got a formal warning, but the worst thing was that Oliver and the other directors at the clinic, well, they looked at me differently. I should have known better, but I trusted her because she's my sister. It's taken a long time to earn back their faith in me. So after that, you threw her out? Sam says. His tone is mild, but when I look at him, I'm sure I see something dark in his eyes. Judgment? Disapproval? I frown at him. I didn't just throw her out, I say defensively. I'd only ever made things worse in all of my attempts to help her, and it was only when she nearly ruined my life, too, that I finally realized she had to take responsibility. I enrolled her in rehab for the umpteenth time, and when I dropped her off, I told her that she wasn't welcome back at my place until she actually finished the program. I tried to keep tabs on her while she was in the rehab clinic, but per her usual pattern, she didn't last long. Annie was never uglier than when she was detoxing,
and never more dangerous than when she was asked to hand control of her life over to someone else. I wasn't criticizing you. I'm just trying to understand so I can help. We're going to need a plan. Maybe if we can brainstorm what's gone wrong in the past, we can think of a way to get her some help that actually helps in the future. I hear a clear accusation in Sam's words, but I'm far too tired to tell if it's really there or if I'm just being paranoid. I narrow my eyes and I say sharply, "You're going to find an answer that I've somehow missed all of these years, are you? Well, I've tried long and short-term inpatient programs, at least 3 outpatient programs, and I even took her off to a luxury program overseas. She lasted a week. We've tried Narcotics Anonymous, several secular NA alternatives, a rapid detox clinic, and she's been on and off methadone and Suboxone for years. No one can make Annie do anything she doesn't want to do. In fact, the fastest way to infuriate her is to try to impose rules on her. What rehabilitation program on earth can deal with someone who is so counterdependent that simply setting boundaries with them is enough to see them? I'm aware that my voice is rising and the words are starting to run into one another. But it's only when Sam draws in a sharp breath and pushes his chair back from the table that I realize how hysterical I sound. I break off mid-word, and Sam raises his hands helplessly. There's sadness and hurt in his eyes. I've been embarrassed about Annie all night. But finally, I'm embarrassed about something that's entirely within my control. Sam has been amazing tonight. He doesn't deserve to bear the brunt of my frustrations. Lex, I'm just trying to help. I'm not insinuating that you've missed the obvious. We're both exhausted. We can talk about this tomorrow when we have clear heads. Let's go back and check in on her, and if her BP is stable, we can go home for some sleep. I can't go home. I shake my head. I need to stay with her. You have to take care of yourself first, Lexi. Well, I've tried that too now, and that approach appears to have been the worst failure of all. I snap again, and I rise and throw my half-empty coffee cup into the trash. It splashes up the sides of the bin and to the wall beside it, as Sam watches in silence. When I turn to him, I'm not embarrassed anymore. I'm only angry. How can he not see how impossible this situation is? She needs me. But you should go, I add curtly. Get some sleep. I'm not going without you. Come on. No! The word echoes all around us in the otherwise silent cafeteria, and its edges are hard and fierce. It's jarring. Sam's gaze doesn't waver. Everything is going to feel better after some sleep, I promise you. But I'm supposed to look after Annie. I promised Dad, and I've let her down, and I've let him down, and I just can't fix it if I'm not here. You haven't let anyone down, Lex. Your sister is sick, and she has made some bad decisions. He speaks firmly to me again, and I want to crumble and sink into the comfort of the arms he opens toward me. But I can't. I step away from him, and the backs of my thighs collide with a chair. Sam sighs and exhales, then runs his hands through his hair. We stand there in that frustrated silence, until I see his expression soften. If you don't want to leave, we can go sleep in one of the residents' bunk rooms. We'll let the staff know where to find us if anything goes wrong. We could be back in maternity in 2 minutes if she needs us. It's a compromise, a good one and a sensible one. I can see Sam would much rather go home, and I don't blame him. We won't sleep well here, and we're both exhausted. Still, there is no way I'm leaving this hospital until I'm sure Annie and the baby are fine. So Sam's suggestion is the only way either of us are getting any rest tonight. I nod. Sam steps back toward me and wraps his arms around my shoulders. I move into his embrace and press my face into his neck. You're a good sister, Lexi. She's lucky to have you. She's a mess. You should have known her before. She was amazing. Maybe this is rock bottom. Maybe this baby is the chance she needs to be that person again.
As we walk back toward maternity, I try to cling to Sam's words as if they are a lifeline. I want to believe he's right, but my hope feels fragile, hollow almost, because we've hit so many